It is 18 hours 35 East African time. Time for John Sibi Okumu on Wednesday. Hamjambo na karibuni. Hello and welcome. First of all, I must say that I made a mistake in the last episode for which I would like to apologize. The correct version of Article 43 of our Constitution 2010 in the Bill of Rights actually begins, "Every person has the right to the highest attainable standard of health, which includes the right to health care services, including reproductive health care, to accessible and adequate housing and to reasonable standards of sanitation, to be free from hunger and to have adequate food of acceptable quality, to clean and safe water in adequate quantities, to social security and to education." Do forgive me for the misinformation in the last episode. And do continue to give us feedback, hopefully positive and reassuring, on the Twitter handle at Capital FM Kenya, or drop us a text or WhatsApp message on 071-984-984. For this episode, I was put in mind of the words of an elected official who was welcoming a huge crowd to a comedy show in one of our cities. Let me quote from his exact words. "Kenya is for each and every one of us," he said. "Kenya is actually a democratic country where we can live anywhere, we can stay anywhere, and we can do business anywhere in Kenya. What I want to tell each Kenyan is, please, during the preparation for the elections, during the elections, and after the elections, peace is paramount. Let's observe peace. Let's observe peace wherever we go." Well, a call for peace like that one would not be necessary unless there have been moments of unrest, upheaval, turmoil in the past. And there have been. Our guest, who will remain a mystery for three quarters of our conversation, is well placed to remind us of such defining moments in our history. But before that, let us hear responses from Wananchi to the question, what is the worst moment in Kenya's history that you yourself have lived through? In Kiswahili, ni wakati gani mgumu zaidi uliopitia maishani mwako katika historia yetu ya Kenya?
Well, 144.60, that is too much. If you go to supermarket, you go with 1,000 shillings, you only buy one item. It is the worst moment.
Kwa hivyo wakati ya corona tuliumia sana, na hata mabiashara ingine ikafungwa.
August 1982, it touched me directly. Soldiers could walk into the house, order everybody out, you line out and lie on the ground. You don't know whether you are going to be alive the next minute.
I'd say the 2007 post-election violence. It was a really dark period. I was kind of young back then, but getting basic commodities was a problem. We were locked up in our estate, couldn't go anywhere. It was a really, really trying time. I lost a few relatives.
But hiyo ndio the worst, kwa sababu niliona nikikufa. Na hiyo ikanifanya kabisa politics na mimi, na hiyo nianga pale natoka mbio. Raila akakuwa anakuja kujiapisha pale Uhuru Park. So zikakuwa na ile live bulletin kwa sababu tulikuwa na ile guns, tulikuwa tunarusha mawe. So nilinusurika. Juu risasi ilipita kwa mkono yangu, niliona kabisa mimi nikikufa.
The Dusit terror attack. Actually, I think I was one of the first people to know about it before it even broke out in the news.
Tuko na shida nyingi sana sababu hata iko watu hapa wanalala na njaa kwa sababu hawana uwezo ya kupata chakula.
So this is the worst experience ever kwa sababu previously tumekuwa tukisuffer juu ya bei, but sasa hivi ni kwa sababu ya inavailability, like unapata hakuna
kazi. Vijana wetu hapa mitaani hii kusema ukweli wamekuwa mbaya sana.
The defining moment in the Sinai fire was the negligence and the sheer loss of life for people who were living in the slums. So a lot of people died when they could have been saved.
Madam, if I may, would you like to comment on what you have just heard?
Thank you, John. I find it quite interesting that a lot of the people who were interviewed took a very personal view of this question. For them, a lot of the worst moments in their history were very close to home. The hunger, the suffering, the lack of work, the lack of money, the fact that the cost of living is going up, inflation. And more recently, the corona, which affected lots of people. But we've had a lot of terror attacks in this country, which were, one lady mentioned, the Dusit attack. But we had Westgate, we had the US Embassy. And in many people who are listening probably don't remember the attack on the Norfolk Hotel at the New Year of 19, I believe it was New Year's Eve 1980 or 81, I can't remember the exact date, when people were enjoying themselves, having a great time at the Norfolk Hotel for their New Year's, and an outsider, a terrorist, put a bomb and let it off. And that affected an awful lot of people. I had a neighbor who was a nurse, and she went into the hospital to help. She volunteered to go in, and she went into the hospital and helped, and she said she had never seen such terrible burns. So that is one of the things that I personally remember as a terrible incident in the history of Kenya. But many of our listeners may not remember that because they are probably not as old as I am. The coup also in August 1982, my youngest son was a small baby, and that was very scary. We were living in Lavington at the time, and we tried not to go anywhere because we felt that if we did, we would be leaving ourselves open to trouble. I used to live in Uganda when I was a girl, and we had troubles in Uganda, as you probably know, if you know the history of Uganda. And my mother said to me once, she said, "You need to keep a low profile if these things happen, because nobody wants to attack you." So during the August 1982 coup, we stayed at home. We were fortunate in that we had plenty to eat in the house, and we just didn't go anywhere. We didn't go to work or anything for a few days. But I know there were many, many people who were very badly affected by the violence and the lack of discipline among those who should have been known better.
Well, it's interesting that one of the comments had to do with the post-election violence of 2007. And since the focus of this first series of programs is on the forthcoming elections, again, we hear that people live in a certain dread of a reliving of those awful years. Would you like to comment on that?
I most certainly would not want ever to see that again. It is a crying shame that in a country like Kenya, which where the people are so wonderful, that they allowed themselves to be sucked into this kind of violence. And I find that it is not what we want to see in our country. And I hope and I pray that it will never happen again.
Would you like to explain what happened to you? Because, okay, it's a conversation. Let me be truthful in saying that given my relatively privileged position in our society, the idea was to sort of go into a bunker, not leave one's home, watch the news to watch unfolding events, but go nowhere until it all died down. There's a follow-up question to this, as you can well imagine, but I'm asking you, how did you live through 2007?
Well, of course, the bunker thing applies to the August 1982 attempted coup, because that's what we did then. But in 2000, and during the post-election violence, we were actually not at home because it was New Year, Christmas, New Year holidays, and we had gone, my family and I had gone to the coast. So for us, it was not so terrible because we just stayed there. So we extended our holiday. We couldn't get back because there was not enough fuel on the way. You know, I mean, from Malindi to Nairobi, it's a long journey, and there wasn't enough fuel. We were told that there wouldn't be fuel on the road, so we decided that it would be better to stay put. But I think we came home after a couple of days, and then we just heard the stories that were going on. Once again, we bunkered down, and I think we just heard the stories, and some of them were pretty frightful. One of the worst affected areas was El Diret, and that's a place that's close to my heart because I studied there as a girl. So I was very sad that there was such, that it took a lot of the, it got the brunt of the violence.
We have to take a break, quick one. Madam, I set you up as being a repository of historical memory going, I wasn't sort of saying that, you know, you're like some biblical character who's 999 years old, but perhaps you, the furthest we had of the memory of our interviewees amongst one ancient was seemed to be like 1982. You took us back to the Norfolk. Now, I want you to go back in time, because we always accuse ourselves of knowing little about our past history. How far back can you go to moments of upheaval? Could you do Mau Mau, for instance?
Just the fringes. I came to Kenya when the Mau Mau was in its last throes, if you like. And I do remember being mildly affected by it. We used to go to school on the train, and the colonial government, as it was then, provided a police escort with dogs for the young people who were travelling up to Eldoret and Nairobi from Kampala and from Mombasa to ensure their safety, because it was a time when there were schools for different races, and so there was lots of children, European children, in these trains. And obviously they might have been a target. So we were protected by police. And I remember the Alsatian dogs, the German Shepherd dogs that used to patrol the trains. I didn't have any personal experience of it, but when we first arrived in the country with my parents and my siblings, we came up from Mombasa to Kampala, and it should have been, I think, a 24-hour journey. I was very little then, so I don't remember exactly. But we were stopped in Voi because there was Mau Mau activity in the area. So we had to sit in Voi for 12 hours. And my mother tells the story of my father sitting on the edge of his bunk in the train with his head in his hand, saying, "Oh my goodness, what have I done? I've brought my wife and my young children to this country, and have I put them in danger?" But obviously we lived to tell the tale, so we are. We were fine.
Do the words political assassinations in Kenya mean anything to you?
Oh, yes.
Which ones?
I remember J.M. Kariuki. I remember Robert Ouko. Those are the two that spring to mind immediately.
Well, elaborate for our younger listeners. Go for J.M. Kariuki first. What was all that about, to your understanding?
Well, to be honest, I don't really remember. It's such a long time ago, but I do remember that he was murdered, and it was a source of great sorrow, and it sparked student riots. And my husband worked in the centre of town, very near to the university, so we actually had to again barricade ourselves inside the shop because the students were rampaging across Jivanji Gardens and throwing stones and rocks and breaking the windows of the various shops in the area and offices. So that was quite unpleasant. I remember the Robert Ouko went missing for a long time, and finally they found his body at the foot of a cliff. But beyond that, I don't really remember very much about it.
Well, we're going back on this theme of maybe violence, destruction, and upheaval is something to avoid. So I'm going to indulge you, move up the ladder so that your youngsters who don't know about these things might dare to look them up. Nowadays, one can Google things for want of. So there are two names to Google. What else can you remember?
I remember when multi-party started. Well, when the movement
1992
when the movement started,
right?
And up until then, we'd had only one party, and there were those who felt that this was not democratic, so they decided they would try and start their own parties. And there was one particular politician whom I knew a little, who was treated very badly, shall we say, and I don't know if I want to name him or not.
No, don't. That's not them. That's not our show. Let other people's name names. We're talking ideas.
But he was, he stood up for what he believed in, and he suffered as a consequence, and he suffered very badly. And I feel that this is not the way to go about things. The people who are in power should not be afraid that somebody who speaks out against what they believe is a threat. They should, we according to the Constitution, and I listened to your program last week, and according to what you said, we have freedom of speech in this country, according to the Constitution. And so I believe that we should really have freedom of speech. We shouldn't be afraid to say what we think and what we believe. And for somebody to be tortured and taken away and murdered because they have had the temerity to speak out is not the ideal for a democratic country which wants to be thought to be in the 21st century.
Well, you're suggesting there, I mean, we've got to give ourselves the self-flagellations that can go on forever, but we have moved forward from the idea of people sort of queuing behind the supposed choice with some sort of imposition on them. We've left queue voting. Would you say now in 2022 that we're gearing up for elections where there's really no scope for the abuse of the democratic process? Or do you think that they can still be manipulated despite our gizmos, but despite everything that's been put in place to make sure that one man, one vote, one woman, one vote actually works?
One person, one vote.
Yes.
I'm afraid that it is very possible because it has happened in countries other than ours. And it is well known that it has happened in countries other than ours, which are allegedly more sophisticated, more democratic, and there is always scope for manipulation. There is always scope for fraud, if you like. But if the things have been put in place to stop that or to prevent it, one hopes that they can work. But I don't believe that they can work 100% because they don't work 100% anywhere.
Oh, is that a terrible admission that democracy doesn't actually work? We've been wrong religion.
I think democracy works, yeah. But it can be manipulated. And it's like everything can be manipulated. So,
I want you to say comment. I'm asking for comments. Is the level of politician that has evolved in the Kenya that you know, are we getting better or worse or more of the same in terms of leadership?
I'm afraid it's more of the same. If you look at if you read the news, the same old names keep cropping up over and over and over again. And one wonders, where are the young people? Where are the new minds, the new ideas? Where are they coming from? Because we don't seem to have an awful lot of them. There may be one or two lurking in the background that I don't know about. But whenever I read an article about current politics, I seem to see the same old names that I've been seeing for the last 20 or more years. And I find that very sad. I really do find it very sad.
An unfair question to you, and that is that this is home, and we're going to do the reveal later, but we're keeping it under wraps for now. Do you think that over the years we have been a more inclusive society? So we're going to take out the two words race, that's colour, the Martin Luther King thing, I want my children to be able to, etc., etc., and then tribe, ethnicity, whichever you wish to go with first, terms of progression, tribalism and racism.
Have we moved forward, you're asking?
Yes.
That's a loaded question, John. I wonder, because in the nearly 50 years I have lived in Kenya as an adult, I think there is a large proportion of Asian and a smaller but significant proportion of European background people living, and yet the number of those people who have their representative in parliament is negligible. So I just wonder if it's because they don't care, so they don't put themselves forward, or is it because they are afraid to put themselves forward, or if they just think, well, there's no point in me putting myself forward because I won't get elected anyway.
Okay, well, that's, I was hoping for a bit of optimism from your responses and comments, and I'm not getting it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, we have had, famously, we had one gentleman who was very, or one family who were quite prominent on the political scene.
Yes.
And there have been some Asians as well who have put themselves in and done well, I think. But I think maybe there is an apathy in the community which doesn't... I'm sorry, I'm still not being very optimistic. My son tells me I'm negative. Maybe I should try and be more positive. But on this in this instance, I'm afraid I don't see it, really, that we've come forward. Tribalism, I think now there are a lot of... Your young man last week in his talk, he said that he comes from a sort of mixed family, and he was born in one place and brought up in another. And I think that possibly the events of 2007 did open people's eyes to the fact that this is Kenya. This is not Maasai land or Kikuyu land or Luo land. It is Kenya, and we should all be Kenyan together. So I hope that that is among the young people, that is going to be something that we see progress going forward.
That's an optimistic note. We'll stop there for a while. Madam, I'll give you another quote, that Kenyans only seem to come together when one of our athletes, or many of our athletes, win the gold, silver, bronze, and are in fourth, fifth, and sixth position, or our rugby team does well in the Hong Kong Sevens. But that aside, we do not see ourselves as a nation, and that this carries through, this idea of national cohesion goes into politics, where it's very easy to divide the country into little segments and play a little, if we have this segment aligned to that segment, then if our man or woman will lead. And that's what sort of triggers all the violence, because some people think, you know, half of us are not represented. Now, again, people have noted your accent, clever as they are. What do you think about this, you've said 50 years I've been in this country. What do you think about that as a as a person who belongs to this country.
That we're not a nation, you mean?
Mm.
I think we are.
Well, I did give you an image where there are things that do surround
there are
us.
Things that...
I think there's one name we can name. When Eliud Kipchoge runs the marathon in under, you know, I think everybody who had an instrument that could see that saw those miraculous 2 hours. But they're few and far between. Yeah. And they relate mostly to sport.
To sport, yes.
I'm looking again to the elections because that's our chat. Mm. Because are we going to be riven yet again by, quote unquote, tribal alliances as opposed to ideological alliances? The nation we want.
The ideology of many of the people who stand for office doesn't seem to me to be very strong. And I fear that there are still many people who have the vote who will not look at the country as a country. They'll look at their little portion of the country. And I find it, I've wondered for some time why the country was divided into smaller and smaller pieces in terms of government.
Right, the whole idea of devolution.
Yes. Because
and the threat that there could be more bits and pieces still?
I understand that, but I don't think it's probably the best idea. But then I'm not in government, so maybe they find it easier to cope with smaller units, if you like. I really can't, in all honesty, answer the question that you're asking, whether we are a nation or not, because... I don't know enough about the people outside of the place where I live.
Right. So are you, madam, describing yourself, and there are lots of them in my family and amongst my friends, who say that they're not interested in politics?
Absolutely. I'm really an apolitical animal.
Well, I will. It's unfair. You know, the trouble with these sort of live shows is that poor you, you've got no idea what I'm going to ask you next. I guess that's why politicians always say we have a list of the 10 questions, and that's why we're not doing that kind of show. So I'm going to ask you now, how dare you say that you're apolitical when you're part of what politicians do? It's going to affect you directly. Would you say that of your own family, as a mom, as a grandma, I'm not interested in what happens in this family?
No.
I find that a terrible... Well, sorry to be judgmental, but I... but do
you
comment...
You are perfectly welcome to be judgmental. I think when I say I'm apolitical, I don't follow any particular... In this country, I don't follow any particular group or political leader or aspirant. I believe in the Constitution, and I wish that it could be followed the way the people who wrote it want it to be followed.
Right, so I'm going to stick in a question there. Again, I've put it to my family and friends, rather like all the great religious tracts that we know, the Bible, the Gita, the Quran, have you read the Constitution from cover to cover?
No, I haven't, and I haven't read the Bible from cover to cover either, John. So
right. So which bits of it do you believe in?
Well, the bits that we were looking at today about the rights of Wananchi to education, to healthcare, to safety and security, to all those things that we should be able to take for granted almost, but people in this country cannot.
Right. Well, you know, the awful thing, madam, is that when you look at, I'm glad you said world politics, because if you look at other countries now, and again, let them remain nameless, but, you know, all the sort of, you know, the word Partygate sort of emanating from our so-called colonial masters, it seems to me that politicians everywhere take the masses for a ride.
Oh, absolutely. I look around the world, and apart from the gentleman who is currently defending his country to the hilt, I don't see a single real Churchillian type statesman. We have politicians, we have leaders, but we don't at the moment, and we haven't had for a long time, statesmen, people to whom we can look up and say he has complete integrity. And even Churchill actually didn't have complete integrity. But I hope there's nobody out there who's going to shoot me for saying that.
We'll get you a bulletproof vest on your exit from here. Don't worry.
I think at the moment there is a dearth of politicians who in all over the world,
right,
who can be trusted.
Right, but this sets out to be a Kenya focused program, and we are heading towards elections. And we've just said, I'm apolitical, these things are all too much. So what if we multiplied and had the 50 million odd Kenyans? What if we multiplied people who think like you and they came to 40 million? Why have elections if everybody thinks that there's no merit in them and they're not worried about politics? Why have leaders?
I don't believe that there is no merit in elections. Absolutely not. I believe that in Australia, it is not only your civic duty, but it is your legal obligation to vote.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
And I believe that should be the case in all countries. That if you have the vote, unfortunately, I do not have a vote anywhere. But if I had a vote, I would exercise it. That I do believe in. I believe that it is the civic duty of every citizen who has the opportunity to vote.
Right. So I'm going to ask, Madam, how do you keep abreast of what is happening politically in this country? Or not at all? You just go and do the shopping.
I have to confess, John, that I don't really consciously keep abreast, but I listen to the people who work for me, in my home, and like you, I occasionally take an Uber and I talk to the driver, and I find it very interesting what they have to tell me. Different views, different aspirations, different requirements. And that is how I keep abreast of what is going on.
Let's go back to those voices of the Wananchi that with which we began, where you had people sort of talking about the high cost of living, being unable to buy food. Again, apolitical as you are, and assuming that they're people who are about to vote, how would you encourage the person you want to lead this country to lead us towards food security, for example, that other countries around us, dare I say it, are somewhat doing better than Kenya in assuring? We have a drought even as we speak.
I know we have a drought, but many years ago I read an article in one of the local newspapers which has remained with me up until now, and it was about a project that had been set up in somewhere in the north of Kenya, and I can't remember exactly where it was, but it was a village where an NGO had set up an irrigation scheme. Now, you asked me about food security. They had set up an irrigation scheme, and the people of that village were able to grow, and it was quite a drought-prone area. They were able to grow sufficient vegetables, not only for themselves, but also for their neighbours in the neighbouring villages. So they not only fed themselves, they fed their neighbours and they made money. And it occurred to me then, and it has occurred to me many times since, why does the government of Kenya not implement simple irrigation schemes so that we can be food sufficient and grow our own food, even if a lot of our country is prone to drought?
But I'm going to ask you, well, you can't answer this question because the politicians are on the trail making promises, electoral promises, to the would-be voter. It seems to me, I'm going to urge you to adopt a new religion in the next 15 minutes, and that is to take some interest in what's going on, because I haven't heard any aspirant suggest a solution to the problem of food security. I haven't heard any politician talk about how they might address the idea of land, which has always remained with us in your historical memory, mm-hmm. all the way from colonial days, the handing over of plots of land, the relocation of people because there was overpopulation. We have repercussions of that to this very day.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I'm trying to link it to the notion of nationhood, these issues are still festering like a wound but haven't been addressed directly. Isn't this a recipe for further political disaster?
Yes. Yeah, it probably is, yeah. Because where people are translocated, if you like, from where they feel they belong to where they feel they don't belong, they're not going to be happy, are they? You don't want to move from your home to somewhere. You don't want to be an internally displaced person or a refugee.
But then you could say that this has always been whatever land, Jubu Jubu land or Chiki Chiki land, and I'm a Buju Buju and you're a Chiki Chiki. we're not being too national here, because if you look at, quote unquote, out there, in the, an American has every right to travel all the way from California and set up in Florida with a sort of 10-ton truck with all his belongings. And people can do that in the United States of America, I believe. I've never lived in the States for any length of time. But isn't that a gain we should have achieved maybe in 60 years, where we can move about and feel that as citizens we can live anywhere?
Yes, but voluntarily. What I was saying was that if people were moved against their will, then that's a different matter. If you live in Nyeri and you decide you want to go and live in Kajiado, you should have the right to do so. For whatever reason, if you've bought land or you want to farm or whatever. But to be forced out of your home, and as people were in 2007-2008, we don't want to see that again.
I'd like you to make one more, maybe my thinking is a bit discordant, do forgive me. Let's go back to the vox pops that had to do with political violence. This idea of 2007, 1992, moments in our history where people did nasty things to each other and to each other's property. I'd like you to comment on whether you think there is a solution to that in the Kenya that you've known over 50 years plus? Because again, if it's an unfair question, we'll leave it at that and in a way expect it to happen again. That's a sort of hook to that question.
We can only hope that people can learn the lessons of history.
But you know, madam, the idea has always been that we will learn from the past. There's a great sort of narrative out there saying Kenyans would never, ever relive 2007, for example.
Yes.
But we've seen in world history again,
yes.
We only have to look to, again, we can talk about Ukraine. We've only seen history replaying itself in ways that we'd never thought imaginable.
That we not only never thought imaginable, but never wanted ever in our lives to see again. I mean, probably, actually, you and I haven't seen it because we were both born after World War II,
right.
Just.
Yes.
But the idea that those atrocities are being perpetrated again in the 21st century is just horrendous.
And do you think that we Kenyans will never repeat 2007 because, again, we've learned our lesson?
I can't say that. It's very possible that Kenyans are better than the rest of the world and they think they have learned a lesson. I hope so. But looking at what's going on in the larger world, people have very short memories.
I'm going to end this particular segment by reading from our beloved Constitution, Article 29 in the Bill of Rights, and it says that every person has the right to freedom and security of the person, which includes the right not to be, and I'm going to quote from C, subjected to any form of violence from either public or private sources, and F, treated or punished in a cruel, inhuman, or degrading manner. So let's hope for that, and we'll take a break. Madam, I know, but our listeners don't know. Who are you?
I am Claire Jetwer. I was born in the UK in the north of England, shortly after the end of World War II. I came to East Africa as a small child in 1955. I actually set foot on Kenyan soil for the first time on February the 4th, 1955. I was with my parents, my older sister and my two younger brothers. And as I mentioned earlier, we were on our way to Uganda. My father was a teacher and he had been employed by the British government to train teachers in Uganda. So he did that for 16 years, first in the bush in a place called Busubizi. And then he moved to Kiambogo, which is near Kampala. And then he moved to the Institute of Education at Makerere. So we were living in the bush for 8 years, 50 miles from Kampala. And there was no school for me and my sister. So we were sent to Loreto Convent in Eldoret, which is why I mentioned earlier that I have a love for that town. Although I didn't see it for about 52 years once I left. I didn't go back until 2013. But that was just happenstance. And I studied here. Then I studied in England for a while. I did my tertiary education in England and France. And I worked in England for about 3-4 years. And my last job was with the Institute of Development Studies in the University of Sussex, and they sent me here to do a job where I was working in conjunction with the Institute of Development Studies in the Nairobi University. And the day after I got here, I met my husband, who was introduced to me by a colleague from IDS Nairobi, and we were married in 1974, and I came here to live in November of 74. We had three sons, two of whom live in this country. One of them is married and has two children, and we live together. And the other one lives on his own, but we see a lot of him. And my third son lives in England with his wife and four children. And I love living in Kenya. I can't imagine living anywhere else. It is home. I've been here for 48 years, almost. And if you count the 20 years between me arriving here and coming back as a bride, if you like, I suppose I've lived here all but 7 years of my life.
I'd like to ask, I had somebody like you deliberately come on to this program to be a representative of what, if you accept that term, the Kenyan expat. And I will ask, because you've said you don't vote, what is the explanation for having lived here for all these years but never taken up citizenship?
Well, up until very recently, I didn't have the option to become a citizen. But when they changed the constitution, anybody who had been married to a Kenya citizen, which my husband obviously was, for more than 7 years would be eligible. However, there is a monetary aspect to this. I am not a wealthy woman, and it is quite expensive to take out Kenyan citizenship. But I have applied for permanent residency. Unfortunately, the application has been in the ministry for a very long time, and I don't know what's happened to it. But also, I have never really wanted not to be British, which sounds really strange, but...
But okay, let's get, if I may, when you are laid to rest, to speak euphemistically, will it be, you know, in the green hills of Kent or Shropshire?
Oh, God, no.
Or will it be in Kenya?
Well, I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the next few years? I will be laid to rest wherever I turn up my toes. But if I die in Kenya, I shall be buried in Kenya or cremated in Kenya. And if I die in the UK, which may happen, I mean, I go there quite a lot.
Okay. No more talk of death. Let's abandon that topic for a while. But I'm interested in Jetwa, because obviously that's a South Asian name.
Right.
And in 1974, true love led you to marry a Muhindi for
yes.
us. Now, did you experience a sort of Sydney, Poitiers, guess who's coming to dinner kind of, or were you welcomed with open arms with your would-be in-laws and your husband, vice versa? What was it like to have a mixed-race marriage in 1974? If you would, I mean, you don't have to comment.
No, I'm quite happy to talk about it. In our case, ours was not the first in his family. His sister and one of his sisters and one of his brothers were both married, one to a German and one to an Englishman. So I was not the and one of his nephews also was married to an English girl. So no, I was not the first non-Indian to marry into that family. The reason they didn't like me very much, I don't think, but I think they thought I was after his money, which actually he didn't have very much of. and also I was a graduate.
They assumed that
I was after the family, you know, the family jewels or whatever.
Yes.
I was a graduate, and he left school after O levels. So one of his brothers said. Remarked that he couldn't understand why this intelligent girl wanted to marry this idiot. But actually that was a terribly unfair thing to say, because he was a very intelligent man. He just wasn't academic.
And I dare say, Claire, in those days, there's also the idea of political correctness. It's rather untoward to address people as idiots in this day and age, for whatever reason.
Well, I don't think he actually called him an idiot.
But
he certainly wasn't very impressed with his brother's lack of education, what he perceived as his brother's lack of education.
Mm.
So, as far as my family were concerned, they thought that my husband was the best thing since sliced bread, because he was the only person. My father once remarked that he was the only person who could keep me under control. So,
right,
I'm a very strong person.
Let me draw you on this idea, because you have mixed race. We have now mixed ethnicity. The idea of whatever it has to take to infiltrate another culture. How did you sort of, you know, were you sort of making your samosas and your chapatis on day two and making sure that you learnt all your spices? How did you infiltrate that thing to become acceptable?
Well, you
had no visits from the in-laws whatsoever?
No. His one of his brothers had died a couple of years before, and his widow was very good to me, and she taught me all the cooking.
Yes.
And I took to wearing a sari like a duck to water, because it's a great thing. It's a beautiful a beautiful garment.
Yes, religion, and spirituality,
religion,
the children, the raising of the children, and what path is
food
to be taken.
I learned from that lady.
Yes.
I was born and raised a Catholic, and obviously my husband was a Hindu. We were married in the Catholic Church. But when it came to the children, they were baptized, but I never took it further than that because he was not very keen. So,
in terms of gender, who was making the biggest abandoning the most? Did you as a woman feel that, you know, you had to lose 90% of yourself in order to mix in, or was it a 50-50 split?
Again, his family had always been quite Western in many ways. They were. I mean, his older brother, the one who had died, had taught him a lot about Western culture because he was very interested in it and he read a lot. And so he knew about Western culture. And as I said, he had a sister-in-law and a brother-in-law and a niece-in-law who were English or European.
I know that in the your husband was a business person. I want you to comment on this idea of being an employer and the idea that we in Kenya don't have sort of like rigid rules of pay. So I'm sure you say you were good employers and you employed lots of people. What guided your thinking on what you ought to pay them and what were their rights and privileges?
There has always been guidance for business people or for any employer in this country about minimum wages. So we always followed...
Which are minimal. Yes.
But we always made sure that we didn't only pay minimum wages and we always ensured that our staff were well looked after. In my father-in-law's day, the staff were all fed twice a day when he was running the business. But then when we had one gentleman who worked for us and actually died of cancer while he was employed by us, and my husband looked after him, used to take him food in the hospital, and he couldn't eat, so I used to make soup for him and he would take it to him in the hospital. So I think we were caring employers as well as, you know, following the law.
Claire, I'd like us to end because we have to. I would like you to think back to our central topic, the elections. Now that we've been going down memory lane, and thank you so very much for sharing, and self-revelation is a difficult thing for most of us. I'd like you to, what should we remember as we go into the elections on August the 9th? What's the central message? Be a bit sort of proselytized for a wee bit.
Well, I would like, the majority of the people who are going to vote are quite young, are they not? And
indeed,
many of them will not have voted before. Mm. I prepared a little sentence in Kiswahili. I would like to say to them, kupiga kura ni fursa, ni haki yako na wajibu yako.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So
it is your right and it is your obligation. I am a firm believer that it is your civic duty to vote. But when you go to vote, don't look for the guy who's promising you the earth. Look for the guy who is going to work to help you get the earth.
Thank you very much, Claire Detois. And for you, our listeners, I hope you enjoyed our conversation and that you'll be back again to listen to John Sibiokumu on Wednesday. Bye for now.